Nun Gimel Amud Aleph. And the Mishnah had recorded a machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and the Chachamim. If a non-Jew sells or is memashkein, gives as a security, and let's assume for the moment that what this means is he didn't redeem the security, and the time for the loan that came due has passed, and therefore the person who holds this mashkon, who holds this security, is actually now allowed to take it and do what they want with it. Let's assume that's what it means. So if you either sell it or you memashkein it, you leave it as a security, so does that constitute bittul on the part of the non-Jew? We're going to deal for the moment with the simpler one. The non-Jew sells his avodah zarah, sells his idol to someone else, and the question is, does that constitute bittul? And Rebbe said yes, and the Chachamim said no. So then the Gemara presented, and this we read last time, a machlokas as to the scope of the machlokas. Meaning, who did the guy sell it to? And you could envision that there's a difference between when a guy sells it to a guy and a guy sells it to a Jew. The logic being very simple. If he sells it to a guy, he figures, okay, that guy will use it for avodah zarah. If he sells it to a Jew, he probably figures the Jew is not going to use it for avodah zarah. And we're talking about metal, right now we're talking about metal avodah zarahs, and he assumes that the Jew is going to actually melt it down. And therefore, when he sells it, he knows that what's going to happen to it, and therefore the sale constitutes a form of bittul. Okay. So the Gemara had presented two opinions. One opinion was clear. One opinion, they didn't know who said which, but one opinion was that the machlokas is only when you sell it to the Gemara says, a tzoref of obeit kochavim. A tzoref literally means a smelter, and someone who's a goy. In that case, Rebbe says, you sold it to a tzor of Ode Kochavim, you sold it to a non-Jewish smelter, even though he's not Jewish, the assumption of the guy who sells it is, this Avodah Zarah is gone, he's going to destroy the Avodah Zarah, it's not going to be worshipped. So the sale constitutes an act of nullification, constitutes an act of bittul. And that's what the Rebbe says, and the Chachamim say no, that because he's selling it to a non-Jew, he's not necessarily assuming the Avodah Zarah is going to be destroyed. But, if you sell it to a tzoref Yisrael, so then everybody agrees that that constitutes bittul. The guy sold it to a Jew who's a smelter, so he knows that he's going to melt it and that it's gone. Now, one note here: there is a machlokas harishonim, Rashi and Tosos on the one hand, and the Rambam and many other rishonim on the other, as to whether or not tzoref is dafka. In other words, when the Gemara says tzoref, is it specifically someone who's a smelter on the assumption that when you sell, what does a smelter do? With he buys scrap metal and he melts it down. But if you sold it to a regular person who wasn't a smelter, perhaps everybody would agree that a sale doesn't constitute an act of bittul. Because look, if you sell an avodah zarah to a guy who's not a who doesn't buy scrap metal, so what is he going to do with the avodah zarah? Probably he's going to worship it. And if you sell it to a Jew, what is he going to do with it? Well, he's not going to melt it down. That's not what he does with metal. So he's going to he's going to sell it. He's going to find some. He may not worship it. He'll find some non-Jew worth a lot of money because, you know, here it's already made out of the Zara. He'll sell it to another non-Jew. So some Rishonim claim, the Rambam and others claim, that this whole machlokas only is a discussion when it comes to someone who's literally a tzoref, someone who's a smelter. If you sell it to someone who's not, everybody agrees the sale does not constitute an act of bittul. And Rashi and Tosis claim that no, that tzoref is lav davka, that it doesn't matter, it's really Jew or non-Jew. It's just typically speaking, who do you sell a metal idol to when you're getting rid of it? Who do you sell metal to when you're getting rid of it? The answer is you sell it to someone who's probably going to smelt it down himself. I will point out later where the Gemara, where you might find support for the latter position in the Gemara, because it does make the Gemara picks tzoref, which is a little bit strange to keep going back to that if you don't mean dafka tzoref, if you mean anybody. But we'll come back to that. So there is, again, one view that says the machlokas is only if you sell it to a non-Jew. If you sell it to a Jew, everybody agrees that it's batel. The other opinion that the Gemara cites says the following. It says he says that they argue by a tzoref Yisrael. So the obvious question that the Gemara immediately asks, and we'll pick up there, if you go into the Gemara, after the end of where the Gemara actually begins, it's the 12th line. It's the first word on the line, Ibailahu. It's after the two dots by a few lines. The Gemara had just presented one opinion that says they argue by tzoref, again, tzoref who's a goy, but they all agree by a tzoref who's Jewish, that the sale constitutes a nullification of avodah zarah. And then they quoted the second view, b'chad amar, the previous line, b'tzoref Yisrael machlokas. So the Gemara says immediately, Ibailahu. B'tzoref Yisrael machlokas, avot tzoref ove kochavim divrei akolo bitel. when he said that the machlokas is by its, they argue by its Tzoref Yisrael, did he mean only by its Tzoref Yisrael? But if you sell it to a Tzoref who's not Jewish, then the assumption is it's not Bittul, because you know what he's going to do with it. He's going to just worship it himself or give it to another guy to worship. Is that what he's saying? Oduma bein b'zeh bein b'zeh machlokas. Or perhaps, no, the machlokas is across the board. It doesn't make a difference who you sell it to. According to this second opinion, the Amoraim, no matter who you sell it to, it's a machlokas, Rebbe and the Chacham, and whether the sale constitutes an act of Bittul. Sam?
The across the board seems to be more like our Mishnah, because our Mishnah doesn't make any distinction between if there are any differentiations.
So Sam makes a very an interesting observation, which actually has a certain degree of truth in it, maybe not for the Gemara, but in another context, which is, Sam says, look, the Mishnah doesn't draw any distinctions. It just says, Mechara, Omishkana. So Rebbe says it's Batel, and it's null, and the Chachamim say that it's not. So Sam says the Mishnah doesn't draw any distinctions. So shouldn't we conclude? You want to conclude two things from that, Sam. Number one is that presumably the second Amora reads the Mishnah quite literally, but you would also make a second argument you should make, which is that we should paskin like that Amora, because that's the simple reading of the Mishnah. Nonetheless, the Gemara assumes, at least for one opinion, that that's not true. The Gemara assumes that and I could certainly easily explain the first opinion, which is the machlokas is only by a guy, because mistama, who buys Avodah Zarah? A guy, when it says a guy sold an Avodah Zarah, who do you sell it to? Probably a non-Jew. If you're talking about selling it to Yisrael, the Mishnah didn't even conceive of such a possibility. So that's why one Amora could come along and say, listen, the Mishnah is only talking about a Tzorif guy, but a Tzorif Yisrael, everybody would agree that it's Batel. And then you could make Sam's argument, which is, although the Gemara doesn't consider it compelling, that the second opinion it's also machlokas by Tzorif, he says it's a machlokas by Tzorif Yisrael, which one way the Gemara understands is also by Tzorif Yisrael, but not only by Tzorif Yisrael. Why? Because the Mishnah reads, you know, without any making any distinction. So the Gemara doesn't buy your argument or use your proof. It is, however, a proof in the following context. It's one of those really interesting things. How does the Rif paskin? You're trying to figure out how did the Rishon and paskin in terms of the issue of Tzorif Yisrael, Tzorif Goy, where's the Machlokas, and so on. We can presume everybody's going to paskin like the Chachamim against Rebbe. That's a fair assumption to make. That Yochid V'Rabim, if you have a Machlokas, one individual against the majority, you follow the majority. And the Gemara in Eruvin says that Halacha K'Rebbe Mechave Ro, V'lo Mechave Rav. Whenever Rebbe plays a one-on-one against someone else, Rebbe wins. Whenever Rebbe is outnumbered, Rebbe loses. There's only one Tana who wins, it seems, even against the majority, that's Rebbe Yossi Bar Chalafta. But everybody else, even Rebbe Akiva, wins in a one-on-one, but he loses once he's outmanned. So presumably we're going to paskin like the Chachamim. The question is, we still need to know what the Chachamim's position is. The Mishnah says the Chachamim believe that when the guy sells, it's not batel. Granted, but who did he sell it to? Is the Mishnah only talking about a case when he sold it to a non-Jew, or is it even a case where he sold it to a Jew? So in this context, so the Rif quotes the Mishnah as is, and doesn't say anything in terms of the Gemara's qualification about Tzorif Yisrael, Tzorif Goy. So what conclusion can you draw from that? That the Rishonim draw from the Rif's silence, the fact that the Rif doesn't quote the Shaklin Taya, the whole discussion in the Gemara about who he sold it to, a Jew, a non-Jew, both, can you conclude?
Doesn't matter,
right? And that's the argument that the Rishonim make, that the Rif is not explicit, but they argue, Sam, as you have, that the Rif, by citing the Mishnah and not citing any discussion about it, is assuming that the Machlokas is universal. It's across the board. Vein Mitzarev Yisrael, Vein Mitzarev Goy. So your argument is not a bad argument, but the Gemara still assumes that it's possible for the Rif had a responsibility. The Rif is writing a Sefer Psak. So the Rif cannot afford to omit a Gemara unless the Gemara is irrelevant from the Rif's perspective. Okay. So anyway, the Gemara wants to know, what does the second Amora hold? The first Amora holds, the Machlokas is here, but everybody agrees here. The second Amora says the Machlokas is here. Would he say that everybody agrees here, or no, that they argue across the board?
If we're passing like the Chachamim, who really cares what Rabbi Huda holds?
We
don't know what Rabbi Huda holds.
No. We don't care what Rabbi Huda Nasi holds. We do care, however, what the scope of the Machlokas is, and that's which cases they argued in. If you were to say that they argue by a Tzorev Goy, but everybody agrees by a Tzorev Yisrael that a sale constitutes a Bittul, then even though you paskin like the Chachamim, you should say that a sale is not a Bittul if you sell it to a Goy, but if you sell it to a Jew, it is. So the Gemara here does something very interesting. It's not, the Gemara, normally, the way you try, if you want to know what a certain Amora held, you quote something that he said. But here the Gemara seems not to quote anything that the Amora said, and seems to try to prove something, but it's not answering the question directly. Now there is a version that some of the Rishonim have, Tosfos quotes, that the ending of this Gemara is Teku. The ending of the Gemara is, we don't know what the second Amora held. And then what we're about to read is a proof, but it wasn't trying to answer that question, because what we're about to cite actually doesn't answer what said Amora held. It may make an argument as to what Rebbe and the Chachamim are arguing about, but it doesn't tell us what a certain Amora said. So let's read now what the Gemara tries to do. Toshima. Da'amar Rebbe, nirin devarai kishemara l'chavala, v'divrei chaverai shemechara la'ovda. Rebbe said the following, and the way the Gemara understands this statement right now is the following. Rebbe and the Chachamim argue in two different cases. And Rebbe's just observing, with a great degree of intellectual honesty, that his opinion makes more sense in one case, and their opinion makes more sense in the other case. Meaning, if someone else, a third party, were looking at this machlokas, they would say, look, you make sense here, you make sense there. What is the case? So, firstly, what Rebbe actually said is, my opinion would appear to be correct, when you sold it to be destroyed, kishemachara l'chabala, right? And that constitutes an act of bittul when you sell the avodah zarah so that the person can destroy it. V'divrei chaverai shemachara la'ovda, and my colleague's opinion, who disagree with me and say that a sale doesn't constitute an act of bittul, their opinion would make more sense to the onlooker in a case when you sold it to someone who would worship it. So the Gemara immediately says, "Mai lechavala umai laovda." What does it mean when Rebbe uses those terms? Ilema lechavala lechavala mamish and laovda laovda mamish. If Rebbe meant to say the following, I and my colleagues and I disagree in both cases, both when you sell something for someone to destroy it, and when you sell something to somebody to worship it. We disagree in both cases. My opinion makes more sense when you sell it to someone to destroy it, and their opinion makes more sense when you sell it to someone to worship it. So the Gemara says that can't be. If you sold it for those purposes explicitly, my time a demanda amar bitel, or my time a demanda amar lo bitel. Nobody could possibly argue that if you sell it for doesn't matter what the buyer actually does it. If you sell it to the person with the intent that he should worship it, that's not an act of bitel, because your assumption is it will still be worshipped. And if you sell it to someone with the intent that they should melt it down, it clearly constitutes an act of bitel. So when Rebbe said that we argue by both cases, but my opinion makes more sense here, and their opinion makes more sense there, he could not have been referring to a case where you sold it literally for the purpose of X or Y. Because then they couldn't possibly argue. Neither opinion would make sense in one of the two cases. Ella, what must it be? It must be, elalav l'chavala doesn't mean you sold it for the express purposes of destroying it, but rather, l'misha osid l'chavla, to someone who is likely, in the future, to destroy it, to melt it down. Umanu, and who would that be? So Reif Yisrael. You sold it to a Jew. And la'ovda means, when you sell it, la'ovda doesn't mean you sell it to someone so that they should worship it. Rather, l'misha asa la'ovda, to someone who in the future is likely to actually use it for worshipping. Umanu tzoref oved kochavim. So then when it turns out, Rebbe is saying, as we're reading the Braisa, that we argue in both cases, meaning both whether you sell it to a tzoref guy or a tzoref who's a Jew, but my opinion makes more sense in the case where you sell it to a tzoref who's a Jew, and their opinion makes more sense when you sell it to a guy. Ushmami, now what do we learn from this? That bein bezo machlokes. Now, in theory, the Gemara has proven what? It hasn't actually proven what, again, the anonymous Amora holds. We don't know. There were two Amorim. One holds that way. One holds this way, but we weren't sure what this was. So the Gemara hasn't proven what that Amora held, because this is a Braisa. It doesn't tell you anything what that Amora held. But what the Gemara has done something theoretically better at this point, which is, it's proven exactly what the Machlokas Rebbe and the Chachamim is. The next step you could argue is that it would appear that if in fact this Braisa proves what we claim it proves, we're going to change our mind in a moment, but if it proves what we just claim to prove, that the Machlokas is across the board, presumably the other Amora would hold the correct opinion. Right? You would prefer that not, you would rather not have both Amora and be wrong. Right? At least one Amora should be right. And therefore, if you interpret that Amora as believing that the Machlokas is across the board, so then he's following the Braisa, and because the Braisa clearly believes that the Machlokas, Rebbe and the Chachamim, is across the board. Whether you sell it to a Jew, whether you sell it to a non-Jew, makes no difference. Rebbe says the sale is a bittul. The Chachamim say the sale is not a bittul. So that's how the Gemara presented this Braisa, trying to prove that the Machlokas is across the board. Now, the way the Gemara read the word, the Rebbe's words, Nirin Dvarai, is the way we would read a Braisa reading this. Now, that's how we would read the Braisa. Nirin means it appears, it's logical, it appears to be correct. That's the way an uninitiated person would read such a Braisa. Okay? However, the Bavli has a very, very unique style of reading. It happens to be Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, for some reason. I don't want to say nobody else ever uses this expression, but if you look in numerous places in Shas, Rebbe is the one who uses this expression. Nirim Dvarai, and Nirim, you know, in this, and Nirim, you know, Divrehem in that. And in a number of places in Shas, the Gemara makes the following astounding claim and astounding reading. It says that when Rebbe uses the word Nirim, we read it to mean there's a machlokes, and he's saying this opinion appears to be more correct, or that opinion appears to be more correct. Rebbe is not saying nirim, that we argue, but this opinion is more correct. He's saying nirim dvarai l'chaverai. In other words, my opinion would appear to be correct to my chaverim who argue on me, meaning they don't argue on me in this case. And v'nirim divrei chaverai, to me, that I don't argue on that case. Now, what the Gemara often then has to do is figure out what is that liminal case in between that they do argue about, right? If we thought that they argue about A and B, and Rebbe says, near in my opinion to my friends by B, and near in their opinion to me by A, so then if they agree, we agree by A and B, there's no machlokas anymore. Now, one option would be to say there really was no machlokas, it only looked like a machlokas.
It could be a non-Jew is not a smelter.
Well, no. So, Josh, what you're doing is you're trying to find the liminal case. The possibility certainly exists. I'm just trying to outline sort of, but literarily speaking, how the Gemara analyzes these cases. So sometimes you get, I don't want to do it now, but there's some wonderful examples where Rebbe does one thing and you find actually a third source that somehow seems to be a representation of such a reading. But for right now, what it means is there are two ways of reading Nirin. One way is to read it, there's a machlokes, but this view appears to be more correct in this case. The other is to say nirim to the other party in this particular case. They don't argue on this one. Now, I present that as the introduction to this because the Gemara is going to take a hybrid. The Gemara is going to claim that one of these two nirims means that they argue, but Rebbe says the opinion appears to be more correct, and the other one is that they actually don't argue. In other words, they're only going to argue by one of these two cases, either la'ovda or la'chavla. They're only going to argue by one of them, but they're going to agree by one of them. How does that work literarily? Because in one of the nirims, and we'll see how that works in a second, means that my opinion, that A's opinion appears to be correct according to B in this case. And then the second one of Nirin is going to be, we disagree, but the following opinion looks to be more correct. So let's see how the Gemara does this. The Gemara says, says the following. Lo, you're wrong. It's not that they argue in both cases, and one opinion is more correct, appears to be more correct and in one case, and the other opinion appears to be more correct than the other. No. Lo hachi kamar. Amar Rebbe, Nirin dvarai lechaverai. My opinion appears correct to my chaver. I mean, they don't argue on me. Kishemachara lechabla. When the guy sold it lechabla, which means to someone who is likely to destroy it, to a Jew. Umanu, sorry, if Yisrael. Who was that? A Jew. Sha'af chaverai lo nechliku alai, ela kishemachara laovda ava lechabla moduli. My chaverim, their opinion, they only saw fit to adopt their opinion, is the way we might use the word nirim. They only saw fit to adopt their opinion when you sell it to someone who is likely to worship it, namely a guy. But when it comes to selling it to a Jew, my opinion appears to be correct to them. Rashi points out that if you go back and look at the statement, if the two nirims were to be parallel, go back to the Toshma, about the ninth or tenth to last narrow line in the Gemara. Tashma, the Amar Rebbe, Nirin Dvarai Kishemachara Lachabla. It should have said, V'nirim Divrei Chaverai Kishemachara La'ovda. In other words, most of the cases you have Nirin that is used twice. Nirin and Nirim, but here you don't. Here you have Nirim Dvarai Kishemachara Lachabla. So the Gemara reads that as my opinion appears correct to my colleagues who argue on me in a case of you sold it to someone who will likely destroy it. And then I would read the following. B'divrei chaverai, where do my friends hold their opinion? K'shemechara la'ovda. I think that's even a sort of better way of reading it. You don't have a second nirim. So then what emerges from the Gemara's rereading of the Braisa is that the Chachamim agree to Rebbe by Eitzoref Yisrael, and they only argue by Eitzoref Goy, which was the first opinion of the Amorai. In other words, the Braisa is not sufficiently clear to force one opinion or the other. Right? So that's where the Gemara leaves it now. It leaves it as, we're not sure what, I would say the following. We don't know what the second Amora held, although it's likely he held the Machlokas is across the board. And we don't know for sure what exactly the Machlokas Rebbe and the Chachamim was about, because the Braisa can be read in one of two ways, and the Mishnah certainly is completely ambiguous. The Mishnah doesn't spell it out at all.
If Rebbe says his opinion is more logical in one case and the Chaverim in the other...
No, more logical to his chaverim.
So what? No, so why does he? No, but in the first way you read it, where he said that when my chaverim say makes more sense.
You know, the original the Havam in the Gemara.
So right. why doesn't he hold if it makes more sense to, if it's more logical to a third party? Why is it more? Why doesn't he adopt what the third party would have done?
And you could ask the reverse also.
Yeah.
If so the assumption is that we. In other words,
he has it in the soul.
No. I would say that Rebbe would argue that I could explain in a different way, but you could. One way of explaining this is to say that Rebbe believes that the sale itself constitutes a bittul. In other words, when you sell your avodah zarah, that's an act of bizaya. And the compromisers would say, no, we don't view the sale inherently as an act of bittul, but depending on what you think is going to happen to it, may have an impact upon it. That is one way of doing it. I don't think that's the way the Gemara is reading. I think Rebbe is more likely believing that when you sell it to someone, unless you know that it's going to be used for worship, the seller assumes it's going to meet its demise. And the Chachamim believe that, no, unless you know that it's going to meet its demise, you assume that it will be purposed again for Avodah Zarah. And the compromisers say, listen, I can see each of those two opinions is more likely, you know, one opinion is more likely in this case, one opinion is more likely in this case, but neither one is definite.
I have a question.
Yes.
Would the, in fact, if it was sold and destroyed, would the fact that it was actually destroyed then lead to the conclusion that when it was sold, it was,
I think no. No, I think not. I don't think that's the case. In other words, the issue, the one who has control of Bittul right now is the seller. And therefore, even if the seller is mistaken, he thinks that this guy, you know, he thinks this guy is a very firm guy and he's going to add it to his Abu Dazara stash and worship it regularly, and doesn't realize that he's just a mercenary who's looking for cheap scrap metal, whatever it is. It doesn't matter that he didn't know that fact. So he thinks that it's going to be worshipped, that he doesn't have intent to be mevatel. Now, the truth is, if you sell it to a tzoref who's a guy, if he melts it down, of course he's mevatel. But if you sell it to a tzoref who's a Jew can't be mevatel with the zara once it comes into his possession. But I think the primary issue right now is the intent of the seller. Okay. So now the Gemara tries to take a stab at proving one of the positions. Meisvei, first wide line in the Gemara. Halokeach gurutos mena ok havodei kochavim. Umatza behem havodes kochavim. A person buys scrap metal, you know, from a non-Jew, and then he finds it. Lo and behold, you know, some people find paintings, and it turns out they're lost Rembrandts. This guy buys a batch of scrap metal and discovers this beautiful Buddha in it. Okay, this beautiful metal Avodah Zarah, and now the question is: it's now Avodah Zarah that's owned by a Jew. He's taken possession of it. Is it the Jew's Avodah Zarah? And at this point, there would be no more Bittul anymore. But here's the question: it's also, on the other hand, the Mekach Tos. In other words, if the Jew bought it and didn't know it was there, so his intent wasn't to buy it. It could be even the guy, as we'll see, didn't even intend to sell it. But the guy may not care. But the Gemara says, "Ha'galokeach Kutos mina Akum u'matza bem Avodas Kochavim." He buys it from a non-Jew and he finds an idol in it. Im ad shelonasan ma'os mashach yachzir. If before you pay the money, you made a meshicha. A meshicha is normally a kinyan. But I believe the way we paskin, there's a machlokas reish lakish in Rabbi Yochanan in Bava Metzia in the fourth parak. When you acquire something, what constitutes the sale, the kinyan, so that neither party can back out? So there's a machlokas The Mishnah, the din is very, very clear. If I give you the money for something, and I have not yet taken possession, physical possession of the object, either by doing mishicha, pulling it, lifting it up, and either party can back out. They may have to accept certain kinds of spiritual penalties, but either party is allowed to back out. However, if you do mishicha, if you acquire the object, and then you haven't paid the money yet, neither party can back out unless both parties consent. Now, why would you want to back out? Well, there's a machlokas Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Whether on what is the din d'oraisa here? Dvar Torah. Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish says that Dvar Torah Mishicha Kona. Reish Lakish says that Minat Torah, what actually constitutes the kinyan, is when you actually take physical possession. If you make Mishicha, Mesira, Hagbah, you pick it up, you hand it over, you pull it, and so on. Rabbi Yochanan, who I believe we Paskin like, says no. Dvar Torah Ma'os Konos. Minat Torah, it's the handing over the money between Jew and Jew that makes the kinyan binding. However, the reason why the Chachamim nullified at least partially the kinyan is Shema Yomar Chitecha Nisrafu Ba'aliyah. That I sell you my recorder here. Okay, you give me the cash, but I haven't delivered the recorder. And now, a bull comes charging down, is about to stomp on it. And you know what? Look, it's your recorder. It's not my problem. I'll just watch the fireworks. As opposed to, if I have a stake in it, let me grab it quickly to save it, even though it's your property. So the expression is, Shema Yomar Chitecha Nisrafu Ba'aliyah. Right, I sell you the wheat. It's sitting in my storehouse. All of a sudden, you know, the hut catches on fire. I have no incentive to even try to put it out because it's your wheat. So therefore, the Chachamim made a takana, that the most themselves are not konos, and either party can back out. If everything is intact, in other words, if there's no damage to anything, if a party wants to back out, they have to accept the curse upon themselves, what's called a mishapara. The mishapara means that the one who extracted punishment from the Dar HaMabul will exact punishment from the person who doesn't keep his word. Okay, but if in fact the wheat got burned or destroyed, then you can back at the, obviously the person who gave the money wants to back out, he can take his money back, and since the object was damaged or destroyed, he doesn't have to accept the curse upon himself. So that's the din by Yisrael Miyisrael. So Minat Torah, Ma'os Arkonos, Midrabana Meshichas Kona. By a guy, Meshicha is Kona. Okay, so you don't need the giving of the money. Marshall?
How do you do
Meshicha
on Karka?
Only a metaltalim. Karka, metaltalim are acquired, the Mishnah and Kedushin says, with meshicha, metaltalim, chattel, movable things. I'm sorry. Movable things are acquired either through meshicha, mesira. Mesira means handing over the reins, or hagbah, picking it up. It all depends upon the size and the nature of how you transmit that object. Karka is acquired either by kesef, shtar, or chazaka. Kesef means a giving of a puta, you don't have to pay full value, but you actually give it the same way we do kiddushin. It's a symbolic of the broader kinyan. So you do with kesef, you do write in the shtar, you can write in the shtar, harei sadi kinuyalach, with the shtar, or chazaka means you go and you do demonstrate with permission of the original owner, you build fence around part of the property, you break part of the fence, you put a new lock on, na gadar uparatz is the expression, so that's how you acquire karka. But by karka, there's no concern anyway, right? Shema yomar chitecha nisrafu ba'aliyah. But by movable objects, the concern was that the person who sold it won't protect them before delivery if he has no responsibility. So by a guy, now, here what it matters for is not that the object got destroyed, but the key is, did the Jew acquire the object? Because once the Jew acquires the Avodah Zarah, then it seemingly should be too late. So then Brisa says the following. Imat shalom asan ma'os mashach. If you haven't paid money, but you made a meshicha, yachzir. You're allowed to give the stuff back. That's surprising. Emishinasan ma'os mashach. If you gave the money and then you made a meshicha, then yolech liyamat melach. You have to take the avodah zarah, toss it into the Dead Sea. You can't get enough from that. You can't give it back and get your money back because that would be like a new sale. Now, what's that?
In the Dead Sea.
Yeah. Okay. Not this. Not the metal. Now, so this is the question. It's a very, what is the basis of this distinction? If nesinas maos, if giving of the money to the non-Jew, doesn't affect the kinyan one way or the other, it's the meshicha that does, who cares whether you gave the money? So the Rishonim already point out that me din Torah here, you can back out because it's a meshicha b'taos. Right? It's a mekach tos. It's an acquisition in error because you didn't intend to be moshech that. You thought that there was a box full of metal scraps. You didn't know there was this gem of an avodah zarah in there. So really, the distinction between whether you gave money or not is all on a rabbanon level. It's like a marasayan. Does it look like you really acquired it and you're reselling it to the guy, or does it look like you never actually acquired it? Okay, but that's not our issue for the moment. Okay, that's a side issue. The issue is the following: the guy sold an avodah zarah to a Jew. And the assumption of the Braisa is that it's not batel. It's not batel. Because apparently, mechira doesn't constitute an act of bitl. So now the Gemara, so you see what? That even by Tzoref Yisrael, you see that So I'm sorry, the Gemara says the following: I amris b'shlama b'tzorif Yisrael machlokes. If you say the machlokes is even by Yisrael, so hamani rabbanan he. Obviously, Rebbe would disagree. He would say that the sale constitutes a bithel, but at least you could explain that the Braisa is the opinion of the Chachamim. Here he's selling it to a tzorif Yisrael. Ela I amris b'tzorif oved kol chava machlokes avo b'tzorif Yisrael devrei kol bitel. But if you say that everybody, both Rebbe and the Chachamim, agree that when you sell it to a Jewish tzorif, that in fact it's a batel, then who in this Braisa? Who's the author of this Braisa? Hamani. Now, yes, Marshall.
The opening text of the Gemara does not say that it's a tzorif.
Ah.
I'm assuming only because the quantity of metal being sold that it's implied that it's a tzorif.
Excellent. You've given both the question and the answer. Some Rishonim, the proof that some of the Rishonim give for Rashi and for Tosfos is the fact that the Gemara had a very simple answer. Could have said, this isn't the Tzorif Yisrael, it's just a regular Yisrael. From this, they want to argue, this would be proof for Rashi and Tosos, that Tzorif is lav dafka. It means any Jew, any guy. Otherwise, they had a ready-made answer here. The Ravid's response to that, the Ravid who says it's dafka Tzorif, is exactly what you gave as the answer, which is, who is likely to be pawing grutaos shel kesef? The answer is probably someone who's going to melt them down. Who buys scrap metal? A scrap metal dealer, right? What does he do with the scrap metal? He melts it down. So anyway, that's how they deal with that particular question. But the right now, however you get to it, whether the machlokas is not only by tzorif but otherwise, or whether this is clearly a tzorif, and yet somebody holds that the zara is not batel through sale, so the Gemara says, who must it be? It must be at least the Chachamim of Rebbe. So you see that they argue by tzorif Yisrael against the first opinion in the Amorim. So the Gemara says, no shani hasam da daita de grutos zabin, adaita da vodas kochavim lo zabin. No, in the same way that we argue that for the Jew there's an element of Meshicha b'ta'us, it means the guy also didn't know. The guy didn't know that the Avodah Zarah was in there. He had all the scrap metal sitting there. Somebody accidentally tossed the metal Avodah Zarah in there. So when the guy sold it, if he had known the Avodah Zarah was there, then maybe everybody would agree that it's batel because he had intent to be batel. But in this case, he just sold him the case. And had you told him there's Avodah Zarah in there, what he would do in the future, we don't know, but he never had intent to be mevatel because he didn't know it was there. So shiny hasam da daita de guta zabin a daita de avodas kochavim lo zabin. Okay. So the Gemara seems to leave the debate as we have it right here. But the question, of course, still remains for us, which I'm not going to answer yet, is, okay, but how do we paskin? In other words, again, we paskin like the Chachamim against Rebbe, probably, but how do we paskin in terms of the scope of the machlokas? And bottom line, the question is, if you a guy sells metal to a Tzoref Yisrael, does that sale constitute an act of bittel? Marshall?
I'm sorry, just one last question.
Sure.
Since the intent of the seller is dispositive, and it seems possible in this case to divide the intent of the seller by asking him, did you first mevatel this and you threw it on the scrap heap and you were selling it for scrap, or did your treasured idol accidentally get into the pallet of scrap metal? Why isn't that the right answer? Or how can you rule categorically from this fact pattern not knowing the intent of the seller?
So it could be that the Braisa makes a blanket statement. So the Braisa may be making an assumption. That's a case where a guy sold him a box of metal and didn't even know the Avodah Zarah was there. You're correct, Alpidin. In other words, it might vary. If we could go back and ascertain from the guy, in other words, what were you thinking? That answer might very well be dispositive in terms of how we would rule in this particular case. But the Braisa is sort of giving you stam, and the Gemara's assumption is that the guy didn't know about it. And when the guy doesn't know about it, we don't assume by default that he would be Mavata anyway. Maybe he would. But you'd have to go back and clarify that.
But I mean, you're going back anyway, because the Gemara tells you how to nullify the transaction.
It's true, but the question, it's true.
itself.
It's true, but the question is, it may be that you don't, in other words, it could be you don't want to tell the guy why you're doing it. Right? In other words, there might be all sorts of reasons why the Jew just wants to evaporate and move on. He doesn't want to have to give an whole speech to the guy, you know, you're of a deserter which I despise and I can't do anything with it, right? So you might not rather go there. So, but I think in theory you're probably correct. You know, if these are a Jew and a guy who are very theologically astute and understand each other perfectly and can discuss all sensitive matters, then probably you'd go back and ask him, you know, what were you thinking? You know. Okay.
Do we have another issue of Bittel here? Let's say he sold him a ton of metal and was a Buddha inside. Isn't it Bittel by the quantity?
In other words, he could have measured, weighed the box. Yeah, here's a box of scrap metal sitting in my store.
He sold him a container of scrap metal.
Right.
And a little pitcher that was working with a Zara or a Buddha or a...
Right.
Was inside. Isn't it Bittel B'Shishim?
No. No. Bittel only works, you know. I'm reminded, you can't, okay. It's not, you know, there's an old joke about, I can't say who it's about because we don't make ethnic jokes, but it's making fun of a group that's not particularly smart. And they say this is the entrance exam, you know, to the University of X, okay? And you put your hand between my hand, you know, put one hand out. You know, Josh, go ahead. You're close enough. Put one hand between my hand, okay? Watch very carefully. Which is yours? Okay? So, that's why I give that example. Bittel doesn't work when the object is still distinguishable. So when I open up the box and I can recognize the Buddha, it's like Bittel didn't work there. If I melted it down, then we could talk about the question of Bittel. But until you do so, as these objects...
You do it accidentally. You can't throw it in there knowing all this.
Right. But presumably the guy didn't do that on purpose either. But as long as it's still distinct and you can recognize it, that does not... Then you cannot say Bittel. Okay, even if it weren't, it would be an interesting question. What Bittel is? We're going to start to eventually, as we move a little later in the Masechta, we get into the Ayin Nesach, which is the next major topic. We'll explore the questions of Bittel, whether there is Bittel by Avodah Zarah. But even if there were, this wouldn't constitute an act of Bittel.
So when we Mevatel for Chametz, for example,
the Bittel B'Shishim. Bittel of Chametz is more akin, even if it's a machlokus, whether it is actually Hefker or not. Bittel there is not making the object physically disappear. It's detaching our relationship to the object. Some say Bittel is Hefker, meaning we literally break the bonds of ownership, and some say it's not actually Hefker. You don't need quite Hefker in order for Bittel to work, but it does sort of represent some breaking, at least partial breaking of the bond between me and the Chametz. But that has nothing to do with the Bittel B'Shishim. Bittel B'Shishim means the object doesn't exist anymore. It's disappeared, it's vanished. There, the object exists. It's just that, you know, it's just that I don't have a relationship with it.
I'm just focused on Ben Sheyadati V'Shalo Yadati. In other words, if you're a smelter, then you have a release sign that says, I'm releasing this, whether I knew what's in it or not.
No, so that's a separate question. That's a question within... Again, that is... That's a question in, you know... It may be a question kinyanim. In other words, when I issue such a blank declaration, if it's binding as a kinyan, it's binding as a sale. In other words, if I sell you something as is, you can see the difference in sort of, I'm sure I alluded to before, some of you may have seen the Teaneck family that found a painting in their garage. It turned out it was a lost Rembrandt. Nobody saw this? Right, so I don't know, the lawyers here will explain to me, they took it to an appraiser who praised it for about $250, didn't know it was a Rembrandt, okay, appraised it $250, it went to, I don't know, Sotheby's or something, the auction, and apparently a couple of buyers realized what they were looking at and drove the bid up to like $1 million, and then the buyer, whoever got it, then resold it shortly after for $4 million. Now, what I was struck by is from a halachic perspective, said the entire auction was probably batel. It was a mekach tos. Right, the owners of the painting didn't know that they had a Rembrandt. right? So the people, it must have been the buyers at auction knew. So I don't know, maybe that's considered legitimate and honest in contemporary society. I don't know. From halachic perspective, that's dishonest. If you see, that's called onah. If I see that you have something very valuable, but you don't realize it's valuable, and I give you a nice price, but nowhere near what it's worth, but more than you expected, the fact that you feel good doesn't mean I haven't cheated you.
You're still taking a risk, though. You don't know it's a Rembrandt. They have a real...
No, you can say that you have a Rembrandt. If this is a Rembrandt, you know it's worth a lot of money, but you know that at auction it might sell for $2 million, it might sell for $20 million.
Yeah,
if I think that I got some guy who painted in his garage, you know, I thought it was oil, you know, it was a paint by number of somebody did in his garage, and it turns out it's a Rembrandt, you're not talking about a natural fluctuation in price.
The dealer who bought it for $1 million isn't 100% sure. He has a strong supposition. He's taking a risk.
You know, so if he said to you the following, this might be a Rembrandt, but I'm not sure. I'm willing to take a bet. You know, if you want, you could wait for an appraisal, but you might get nothing from me. I'm willing to give you $1 million now, and I'm understanding that if it's a Rembrandt, I'm going to make $3 million on it, and you're just going to get this million. And if I'm wrong, you just walked away with a king's ransom for a $250 painting. Right? If you want to say that, that's okay. But both parties have to know the risk.
People, it gets bid up. It's a market transaction.
Okay. So, anyway, my point is that if somebody knew it was a Rembrandt, if the people bidding up knew it was a Rembrandt, and we all know that a Rembrandt wasn't going to sell for less than $500,000, then it means that this Mecca, that's called Ono. All right,
I can't leave this for one second. There's a difference between selling it to one person in an auction, right? If you sell it to one person, he might be trying to do something. But in an auction, the market...
I'll make the following comment also. Put that aside. Let's say these two crazy people who bid it up to $1 million didn't even know it was a Rembrandt. They both just loved the painting. To be Mekach Tos and Halacha, you don't need deception. If I accidentally sell you a Rembrandt, okay, not knowing it's a Rembrandt, and you don't know it's a Rembrandt either, I can be Mevatel the sale. It's a Mekach Tos. There doesn't have to be any ill intent. Right, the assumption is if I didn't know what I was selling, and you didn't know that it was fancy either, the halacha would say that. You don't have to impute any dishonesty to the parties here. Okay, that appraiser probably could get sued. But anyway, putting that aside, the question is such a, if you sell it as is, it might very well be, in other words, I go to that case, we don't know how much this painting, I have no idea what the painting is worth. This painting could be a Rembrandt, it could be worth nothing, you know, or nothing. I'm willing to buy it for you, we give you a nice price. You're willing to sell it to me. So if the person says yes, so then arguably the sale is binding. So if you say that's the kind of sale that was transacted, and he says, as is, no matter what's in this box, I know all sorts of stuff falls in, my wife's diamond ring could have fallen here, I'm selling you the box, then it might, then you get into the next question, which is, you know, yes, the sale is a sale from a Mamonos perspective, but from an Isser V'Heter perspective, do you still require his knowledge of the Avodah Zarah? Even if you could turn around and say, I got your Buddha, and he would be upset that he got your Buddha, but the sale would still be binding because he agreed to that at the outset, I don't know if it would still constitute a Bittel. I'm not sure. And as it might be that the guy really needs to know exactly that he sold his Avodah Zarah. And if he knew he sold his Avodah Zarah, then it's Batal, if not. Okay.
There's no onah, to my knowledge, in civil law, in English law.
There is no onah?
None. That's why you can always say, you can do it. Until we established these new laws, there was no onah in civil law. Unless you know of it. There is none.
Okay.
Doesn't it? In any sale, there's no sense of obligation that you have to tell the buyer what you're really selling.
That is actually not true.
In common law?
Correct. There's a concept of latent defect. In other words, if you're selling a house and you have active knowledge.
But you have to have active knowledge.
You have an obligation.
But
the
onoah doesn't require that. Doesn't require
right.
That.
Right. And it does. If I'm selling.
That's why I didn't disagree with your first statement. I only disagree with your second statement.
Okay, so in other words, you're saying that in civil law, I said if you have a Rembrandt and you don't know it, and I know it, and I buy it for you, it's one, you know.
It's, yeah.
Okay, fine. So anyway, that
buyer
is
buyer beware.
That is that
was
that is not the halachic view of such a thing.
Because yes. Buyer
okay.
Beware doesn't appear in Jewish law.
Right. Okay. So, all right. So now the Gemara moves on. But we're not done yet, because we want to keep our eyes open in terms of, does anything in the sugya shed light on how to paskin in terms of the earlier machlokas. Tanu Rabbanan, second line from the bottom on Gimel and Aleph. Lova aleha, o shenafla lema polas, o sheganvu alistim, o shehinuchua haba'ailim v'holchu l'mdinas hayam, im asidim lasar kimelchames Yoshua, eina b'teila. There are four cases here. The last one is a bizarre formulation of a case which is going to immediately catch the Gemara's attention, but that's actually not that interesting. The Gemara basically just said if the guy left, but is going to come back, that his avodah zarah is not batel. Okay? That reference to like the war with Yoshua is a very strange reference. The Gemara will work on that, but I'm more interested right now in the first cases. Lava aleha, the guy lends money, borrows money using avodah zarah as a security. Now this looks like Mishkana. That looks like what he's doing. He was mamashkin it, which is the case in the Mishnah. And what's the din according to the Braisa? It's not Betela. Okay, that's what the Braisa says. Now, if you and I were reading this Braisa, what would our comment be? What would we say about this Braisa? What's that?
He intends to return. That is his intent, to get it back.
Maybe. One said the Gemara is going to make a comment like that, maybe, but if I'm going to change the word, Mishkana, instead of Lavala, Mishkana, Onafla Mapos, etc., it's Eina Betela. What would you comment about this Bryce and its authorship and its opinion? It's the Chachamim against Rebbe. That's what you would say. That's what you might say. Right? Now, the only way to get around it, as Tosfos does, now, you'll see why in a moment it's important, in a little bit. Tosfos says, the Gemara comments the following. The Gemara comments, right where we left off reading, go to the top of Negim on the base for a moment. Utsricha, the Gemara says, why do you have all of these cases? Why do you need all four of these cases to tell us it's not batel? De'itana lava aleha. If you told us the case where the guy borrowed money against it, used it as a mashgon, you might have said midalo zabna. The reason why it's not batel is midalo zabna lo batla. But nafla lema poles. If a building fell on it and he didn't try to excavate it to get the avodah zarah out, it's batel. So notice, what did the Gemara assume right now? It assumed that if it had said lava aleha is not betela, I would assume that was why, because he didn't sell it. Because obviously, if he sold it, what would the din have been? It would have been betela. Now, in the Gemara's discussion of this Braisa, whose opinion is the Braisa? So one suggestion was, well, it's obviously the Chachamim's opinion. But if that's how the Gemara is reading the Braisa, then what is the Gemara assuming for the Chachamim in this case? That if, in fact, he had sold it, it would have been betela. So, but one second, the Chachamim say, if you sell it, it's not batel. So what's going on? In fact, is there any case where the Chachamim believe that if you sell it or mamashkin it, that it's batel? The answer is, it depends who you hold like. Depends which Amora you hold like. Right? In other words, if you hold like the first opinion, the Amoraim, that they don't argue by Etzorif Yisrael, so you could explain that this Braisa, Lavala, Mitzorif Yisrael, and therefore, it's love Allah, but as Tosus will say, he didn't give up possession yet. It's not that he let the Jew have it. It's not like the loan date passed. So you could say, yeah, but had he sold it to the Jew, it would have been batel. If this is the Chachamim's opinion, this Braisa, then you know that that the Gemara here is assuming, like the first Amora, that the Machlokas is only by Etzorif Goy, not by Etzorif Yisrael. And what that would tell you is how to paskin. It would tell you that you should paskin like the Chachamim, but only by Etzorif Goy. And in fact, the position of the Rambam is that when we talk about Tzoref, it means Dafka Tzoref, but it's only not Batel if you sell it to a Tzoref Goy. If you sell it to a Tzoref Yisrael, the Rambam paskins that it is, in fact, Betela. Why? So the Ran explains, we may have a chance not today to read the Ran inside, the Ran explains, because the Rambam looked at this Braisa, he saw Lava Aleha, and he saw the Gemara comment that if he had sold it, it would have been Betela. Now, the Rambam's not paskin like Rebbe, right, this Bryce is not going to be Rebbe's opinion. Tosus claims it is. But the Rambam's assuming by default it's not Rebbe's opinion, it's the Chachamim's opinion, which means there must be a case for the Chachamim when a guy sells his avodah zarah that it is in fact Betela. Now, the only way to construct such a case is to take the Machlokas Rebbe and the Chachamim and narrow it in such a way that there's a case where the Chachamim agree with Rebbe. And that's the first opinion in of the two Amoraim, that machlokes betzorif goy, avo betzorif Yisrael, divrei hakol betela. This is, you know, it's not a significant halachic issue in our lives, but this is really a beautiful teaching example of how the Rishonim paskin halacha, and I would even say how the Rambam read Gemara. Right, you're really working backwards, because the Rambam paskins, you know, most Rishonim say, how do you paskin? Well, it's a sveika daraisa, it's a machlokas amorayim, so by a din daraisa, you should be machmir, and therefore, obviously, everybody knew you paskin like the chachamim, but you should even paskin like the most machmir opinion of the chachamim, which is, they always say it's not betela. Right? If the Rambam paskins splits it and says, only by tzorif goy it's not betela, but if he sells it to a Jew, a tzorif Yisrael it is betela, so the Rambam must have a source. How did the Rambam know to paskin lekula? And the answer is, because the continuation of the sugya, this brisa, the Rambam must have read, works, the pshat would be, it's das chachamim, there's no name attached to it, and the Gemara assumes, had it been a sale, it would have been betela, which only works according to the first opinion of Amoraim, hence the Gemara's conclusion is, machlokas betzorif goy, avo betzorif Yisrael, devrei hakol betela. Anyway, so, again, not so much, not that practical for us, but really it's illuminating in terms of the way we shown him read the sugya. Okay. Now.
Was Rambam somewhat unique that way?
No. Meaning, what makes the Rambam so much fun and so maddening is the Rambam didn't tell us the sources for his psak. And therefore, we're kind of, when the Rambam paskins in a way that it's not clear to why anybody paskins that way or why he knew to paskin that way as opposed to the other way, you're sort of, okay, now it becomes a puzzle. How do you solve that puzzle? The Briskers were eternally grateful for that. Had the Rambam, I don't know if it's true. I don't know if the Rambam actually says this, but I learned once and I assume it was in the Rambam's Tshuvos, that the Rambam was once asked about a source for a particular din, and he couldn't remember where he had gotten it from. I mean, the Rambam was a busy man, right? He wrote the Mishnah Torah, but he spent a lot of time dealing with communal affairs, being the Sultan's physician, and so on and so forth. And the Rambam was not; he couldn't figure out where, why he had paskin that way. What was his source? And supposedly, he said he wished he'd gone, had the time to go back and write, sources, for all of the halachos where he got them from. Now, what happened? Of course, he didn't. What happened later is we have to know, say, Kalim of the Rambam, starting with the Magen Mishnah, who was a Rishon, a Chavrusa of the Ran, and then subsequently the Yosef Kar, the Kesa Mishnah, and then many, many, many commentaries later. But the most interesting occupation of the commentaries really is sometimes where did the Rambam get this din from? So the Briskers would be greatly impoverished in their learning had the Rambam had the chance to write the book. There's an old the joke that's told about the Reb Chaim goes to heaven and they ask him, who do you want to meet? And he's the one person he wants to meet the Rambam. And then he's the Rambam and he starts to say over a whole shtickl Torah about this particular thing, isn't this what you meant? And the Rambam says, no. And he goes to the next one, same thing. Finally, the third Reb Chaim says, stupid Sfardi. It's the end of the story. But nonetheless, that is really sort of one of the central enterprises studying the Rambam. I think we often don't, people ask what was the Rambam's makar, but I think sometimes we should ask actually, how does the Rambam read the Gemara? If the Rambam had written a perush on the Gemara, what would it have looked like? And that's why it's so interesting about how do you read this Gemara. Okay, so anyway, now the Gemara is going to come back to the Asid and Lachsar part in a moment. But now the Gemara continues. He says again, second line from the top on in Gemara and base. Utzricha the itana lavalea midalos abna lo bitla. The fact that he didn't sell it means he didn't intend to be mevatel it. Avo nafla la mapoles midalo kamefani la. The fact that he didn't get a shovel and start to dig it out. Ema batule batle. I would have thought that constant bitla. He said im kvar as kvar. Tzricha the itana. The reason why we would say it's not batel is mishum de sabar hamanchas. It's in a safe place. Whenever I want, call emas. When I want it, I'll get it there. I know nobody else. I mean, that's of course the place you'd always look for somebody's valuable over the zara under the building that collapsed. Nobody's going to go looking there. Aval ganvu alistim. If it was stolen by thieves, I would have thought the fact that he doesn't call the police and make a whole investigation. That you thought that constitutes a bittul, therefore tzricha. If itana ganvu alistim is not batel, I would have said bishum the savar. Now you know why when someone else steals it, he's not he doesn't get so worked up and file a whole police report. Bishum the savar yovid kochavim shakala miflach balchlay. If a guy stole it, so the guy will use it for avodah zara. E Yisrael shakla. If a Jew stole it, Aidi dem me'ayikar mizaben lala over the kochavim upalachla. The Jew's not stupid. He's not going to melt it down. It's worth much more as a Buddha to a Buddhist who will happily buy it and pay a premium rather than just the raw materials. Therefore, Therefore, he's not mavatal. Aval hinichua habaal v'holchul medinas hayam. But if the owners went away and they didn't take it with them, midelo shaklu badayu, from the fact that he didn't take it with them, batule batluha sricha. That's why the Braisa had to tell us that it must. Okay, fine. So that's what the Gemara says. So now that last line was very, very, very puzzling. The Gemara says, "Im asidim lasar kimelchemes Yoshua." Eina betela. One second. When the Jews killed and chased away the Canaanites, they didn't come back. So what do you mean, emasidim lachzor kimelchemes Yehoshua? In Mechemes Yehoshua, they were ein asidim lachzor. So the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, midi milchemes Yehoshua mihadur hadur? Did they return after Mechemes Yehoshua? So the Gemara says, no, Hachi Kamar, im asidim lachzor, if the intent when the goy leaves is to return, which probably might have been the intent of some of the Canaanites when they fled, they hope to come back, harehu kemilchemes Yehoshua, it's like milchemes Yehoshua, and what was the din of the Avodah Zarah in Eretz Yisrael, incidentally, having nothing to do with milchemes Yehoshua? Eina betela. Ve'ein la betela, right, when the Jews came into Eretz Yisrael, remember, they were told they had to destroy the Avodah Zarah. What were they not told they could do? Grab a guy by the collar and have him be your bittul machine. Bevatel this for me, bevatel that for me, right? No, the answer is it was asur already. So, what the Braisa was telling you, in a very strange formulation, scratching its head this way, is that if the goyim left and they intend to come back, the din is like the Avodah Zarah b'mei Milchemes Yehoshua, which is there, it was asur forever, and so too, if the goy intends to come back, even though he doesn't actually come back in the end, it is you took possession of it, it's asur forever. Now the only question, of course, is, okay, very nice, the Gemara could have said this much more simply. It could have just said, eina betela. Why did it have to say, like milchemes Yehoshua? So the Gemara says the following. V'lamali l'misliye b'milchemes Yehoshua, why even make this strange locution? Why bother? So the Gemara says, milsa agav urche kamashmalan. It was teaching us a different din. Now, which is, all the Avodah Zarah in the time of Yehoshua was Asura. The question is why? We've explored this already, we've touched upon this before, but this is where the Gemara spells it out. After all, the Asherah trees, the Eretz Yisrael didn't belong to the Goyim, it belonged to the Jews, because God gave it to Avram Avinu, it was Yerusha Me'avoseim. So how did, if somebody else worships my property, it doesn't become Asur. Ein Adam Osur Davar She'ena Shelo. So the Gemara says, Milsagav Urcha Kamashmalan Kihada Amar Vihuda Amarav Yisrael Shazakaf Levein Olishtachavosla. If a Jew sets up an Avodah Zarah, literally a brick, to bow down to it, but he hasn't done it yet, Uba Oved Kolchavim Mishtachavala Asara. And a guy comes and now worships it, it's now Asura. Why? But the Jew didn't worship it. The answer is because he wanted it to be worshipped. He's happy that the guy worships it. So if a Jew sets up an Avodah Zarah, and then a guy worships it with the Jew's permission, it becomes Asura Bana. Now, minolon da asara, how do you know that that's asar, if the Jew didn't actually worship it? Amar Rabbi Elazar, kitchila shel Eretz Yisrael, like the initial stage of the Jews entered the land of Israel. The Amar Achmana v'asherehem tisrifun ba'esh, the Torah said the asheros are asuros. Michtei, let's see, Yerushahi lahem avoseim, it didn't belong to the Goyim. Ve'ein adam osa davar sheina shalo. Okay, ve'i mishum hanach v'meikara. If you want to talk about those things that existed before God gave Eretz Yisrael to the Jewish people, so if that was the case, b'bitula ba'al masagi lahu, it would have been enough to say any Avodah Zarahs that were owned by the Goyim before him, or Avodah Zarah shel Goy, have a Goy be mevatalad. Any Avodah Zarahs that were worshipped after Eretz Yisrael was given to the Jewish people, then ad asur b'na aro, you don't even need betel. Ella, why did they become Asur? Midepolchu Yisrael le'egel, when the Jewish people worshipped the golden calf, Gilu adatayu, they demonstrated denicha lehu b'avodas kochavim. They were very happy for Avodah Zarah. V'chi'asu ovde kochavim, when the Goyim in Eretz Yisrael then worshipped the Asheros, shlichusa ditu avdi. They were doing the shlichus of the Jewish people. Hachinami, so too, in Rabbi Yehuda's case, Yisrael shazak aflevena, galya daite denicha leb avodas kochavim. The Jew shows that he wants it to be avodas zara. V'chi'asa ovde kochavim, polachla, shlichusa didei ka'avid. He's doing the Jew shlichus, it becomes asabana. So the Gemara then asks, "V'dilma be'egel hu denichalahu, but midiachrin alo." Okay, but who says that the Jewish people wanted everything to be an Avodah Zarah? Maybe just the egel. So the Gemara says, "Amar kra, ela Elohecha Yisrael," the plural. Malamed she'ivu le'alohos harbe. They desired lots of avodah zarah. I have no idea what this means, by the way. I know what it means literally. I don't understand the theology here. And therefore, at the time the Jews worshipped the Egel, they wanted it to be the more the merrier, free-for-all. All avodah zarah is good for us, including the objects that belong to us that you want to worship at that time. So then the Gemara just asks a very simple question. Ema kol debahade egel nitzaru, mikan ve'ilach nishtri. Okay, but the Jews did tshuva. So why don't you say that those things that were worshipped during the Chet HaEgel, those things became Asur Bahana, but any subsequent Asheras that would not have been worshipped before then, but worshipped afterwards, would in fact be Mutter, because the guy cannot be Osur Davashena Shalom. And at that stage, in other words, if a Jew sets up a Levena to bow to it, and then before the guy can bow to it, he says, you know what, I want to do Tshuva, I don't like it, Avodah Zarah is a terrible thing. Then when the guy bows to it, it's down Asur Bahana. It's no longer Nichale. So what about the Asheras that were planted later? So the Gemara says, you're right, but Man Muchach, how do you know? And therefore, they're all Asur. Okay, so anyway, so that's how the Gemara concludes the Sugya. It's a very strange way of teaching us this din. But the din is that if a guy worships the Avodah Zarah that a Jew set up, and the Jew is happy for the guy to worship it, so even though the Jew hasn't worshipped it yet, as soon as the guy worships it, it becomes Asur B'Hana forever, because it's Avodah Zarah Shei Yisrael, and Ein Lo Detela Olamis. Okay, and as far as the Machlokas in the Mishnah, we paskin like the Chachamim. There is a Machlokas of Rishonim, as we said, had a paskin in terms of the Machlokas Amoraim. If I'm not mistaken, the Shulchan Aruch, even though the Rambam paskins Lakula, I think since the Rif and the Rush both assume Lachumra, I think the Beis Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch assume that it doesn't matter who this guy sells it to, if he's not explicitly Mevatel at the sale, does not constitute an act of Bittul.